I'm in Richmond, Virginia. Park, do you want to introduce yourself?
My name's Sean O'Hearn. I've been in Richmond since 95. I've been doing organizing here since then.
So, I don't know a huge amount about Richmond, but tell us a bit about the anarchist movement in the city.
I don't know anything prior to the early 90s. I know in the vague things from the 60s I've heard there was something called the Grove Street Republic, where people blocked the road. Just a few blocks from here, students blocked the road and had a be-in, love-in there for a month before the police busted it up. Ginsburg set off a riot here once in this actual park, reading poetry during the Vietnam War. And there's a story of yippies in town postering the university about how they were going to burn this puppy with napalm at the Lee Monument, one of the monuments to one of those Confederate war criminals. And of course it caused the reaction that they wanted, and hundreds of people came out to stop them from torching this puppy, you know, and they, you know, pulled the prank and were like, well, we care so much for this puppy, but not for the children in Vietnam. And they tried to do a teach-in at that point about, you know, the use of napalm and Agent Orange and things like that. But the main history that I know of the anarchist movement here starts in the early 90s. There was an Anarchist Youth Federation group here that kind of dissipated, and then Food Not Bombs was established by people that had moved here from other cities, actually. One which had worked with Boston Food Not Bombs for several years, and another which had worked with New York City Food Not Bombs. They were both in bands and part of the punk music scene. So when they moved here and they saw the homeless community, there's a large homeless community in Richmond. It's very central to the downtown area. You see a lot of street folks. There have been efforts over the last few years to hide the homeless community. But for a city the size of Richmond, there's a prominent street community, you know. And so having a Food Not Bombs here seemed like it would fit with the politics of, you know, it was punk. You had a lot of punk kids and everything. So they started that, and they did that for, it's still going today. The Food Not Bombs was started in, like, 94 or something. There were other things that were happening in that time, like animal rights groups were popping up. There was a riot girl movement here, like a punk feminist movement. I'd gotten here, and I'd worked with Food Not Bombs in Norfolk in a collective down there that did literature distribution, mainly at punk shows and at protests and things like that. And me and my younger brother moved here with a few friends from down there, and we worked with Food Not Bombs and everything. We didn't really think it was politically oriented enough. You know, you had a lot of folks that just wanted to give out the meal and have that be the totality of the action, and we wanted to do more organizing, and we thought Richmond was a great place for it because of just the makeup of the city. It's a majority African-American city, but city council is almost always majority white, you know. For a long time, you know, the major bureaucrats in the city, police chief, you know, housing authority people, were all pretty white. You know, some of that has changed over the years. It's a very poor city by and large, and you have a mesh of like urban city community with college activism, you know, or we thought that there could be one, you know, and some of us were students, some of us weren't, and so we moved to Richmond partially to do organizing work here. And after the Food Not Bombs group didn't really fit what we were trying to do, we started a collective called General Strike. In the earlier days, it was more specifically anarchistic. You know, we never called it an anarchist collective, but we called it a collective. We reprinted anarchist writings in it, you know, in our newsletter. Our house was plastered with, like, posters of Girardi and, you know, shit like that, you know. But we steered away from using the term anarchist specifically because we thought it would alienate people, you know. That group lasted for several years, did a number of different programs. Started a free food for temp labor workers program. We go out in the morning, they were getting ready for work, and we give them sandwiches and fruit and pastries, mainly stuff that we got Food Not Bombs that was left over. And we were trying to do an IWW chapter at the time, so we give people pamphlets about, you know, right to work, what it means to be in the South, you know, and how the labor movement here has suffered because of racism. And so we talked to the workers there. There's a lot of crossover between the people we knew from the park, from working with the homeless community in general. We did that for a long time and never really made any inroads into the organizing a specific worker group, you know. But there were other things that happened in the city that we used that program to kind of promote and mobilize for. There was police killings were happening in the summer of the 1 year. We staged a police brutality demonstration. we had gone out to the meal program, the one here in the park, the Food Not Bombs, and the one that we were doing, and had spent a few weeks talking to people about this rally and stuff, you know, and we only got a handful of people total, like, but a lot of the makeup was actually from the street community and the temp labor community, so we felt like we were making some inroads with that. We did a prisoner support rotation where we worked with three other groups to support Sekou Kembia, who's down in, it's either Alabama or Louisiana. We did a literature distribution. We called it the Insurrection Series. We had, you know, both like folding, threefold booklet kind of things, and then full-length pamphlets. That group lasted for a while. It worked with a lot of, around a lot of different issues in the city. We always worked on poverty issues. There was always a focus on that because of the closeness of Food Not Bombs. And at that time, there was a homeless organization that sparked up called ASWAN, for a society without a name for people without a home, because they didn't like the term homeless, you know, so there was always this friction, you know, so they were a people without a name, is what they felt, that they hadn't been properly identified. And we worked with them a lot around issues regarding shelters, funding, police harassment, criminalization of poverty in general. Sometimes that meant, you know, organizing a meal outside of city council when we needed to pack a meeting. Sometimes that meant helping get people from the emergency shelter to backup shelters throughout the night, you know, and sometimes that meant holding a march, or we had a tent city in this park here that lasted 3 days at one point. Yeah, that was a really amazing working relationship between the General Strike Collective and Food Not Bombs and this ASWAN group. It worked for a while and did a lot of stuff. One of the things that we successfully did is we raised the temperature at which the emergency shelter opens. It used to not open until 25 degrees or below, which is just inhumane. That's below freezing, you know?
That's right. It's about minus 6 centigrade.
Yeah. And so we don't think the city council people really knew that even, you know, or cared at all. You know, it was just kind of part of the bureaucracy, part of a decision that they had made based on funding and how much money they can get to run it. And they figured that, well, it only falls beneath this temperature this many times a year in our city on an average, so we can afford that, you know? And that was really their bottom line with it. And we worked with the homeless community, particularly that organization ASWAN, and with the Justice Center, a legal aid group that helps low-income people. We mounted a campaign that used pressure tactics and things like that to win an increase. They opened it at 35, which is better. It's not perfect by any means. And the shelter space is still limited, you know. But yeah, so that was the General Strike Collective. It ended up collapsing. It was being pulled in too many different directions. It's kind of one of those things where it was actually our successes that we weren't able to adjust and deal with, you know, and use productively. Like when we did the tent city in the park here, we camped out 3 days in the park to protest the university's anti-poor policies and gentrification. We marched at the end of it to the dean's meeting, like to his house, and demanded a meeting. He gave us a meeting, and we sat down with him, and we didn't know what the fuck to say, you know? I mean, honestly, we had a member of the community that's being gentrified, a member of the homeless community, and a student, you know? And it was the 3 points that we were supposed to be making were, like, stop the gentrification of Carver, end the attacks on the homeless people, and, you know, create democracy within your institution. You know, like, let the students create democracy, because there had been a little bit of a movement for that, and that's how we were trying to get the students involved. And we sat down and we said those things, but then, like, as far as a practical implementation policy or anything, like, we were kind of like, we just want you to go away, you know, faltering, you know, and people were coming in with different ideas about the group, and we weren't doing the internal dialogue and internal development, you know, people's egos clashing and things like that. Eventually, the group just kind of scattered, went different ways, and Food Not Bombs was still going this whole time, and Food Not Bombs had gotten more political in the process and had a good working relationship with the General Strike Collective. So a lot of people kind of either went with Food Not Bombs or off into other specific organizations. That was like early 99, probably, the General Strike came to an end, late 89, early 99, 98, 99. And then, pretty much Food Not Bombs was the basic grouping here for anarchists to be involved with. The Flying Brick folks had started their library at that point, but they weren't really doing much other than collecting books and making them available.
Flying Brick's the kind of local info shop, I suppose?
Yeah, it's in a house. It's a library in a house. They do events, and they have several thousand books, mostly radical stuff. Some random, you know, DIY stuff, fixing your garden or your washing machine. Good fiction section and stuff. A lot of zines. And they catalog a lot of old anarchist publications that come out either here or nationally or wherever they get them from. You know, they get subscriptions to papers and magazines and stuff. They've been here for a while. You know, they do shows and host speakers and film series. The projector last night is bought and owned by them. They run their house collectively. They own the house. So they've always, and it's been pretty much some of the same people. So they've been a good point of contact and continuous, you know, struggle for years. So that's always been good. They've been more and less active at different times, you know, depending on who's living there and what's going on with their lives. At one point there was a bunch of bike people living there, you know, and so they would do bike workshops all the time, you know, teaching people how to fix their own bikes and stuff like that. They were at this house over on Cherry Street, now they're on Pine. Sad thing is, it looks like it might be coming to an end. People are going their different ways, and I'm not sure what's going to happen with the books or the house, you know. Some of those people were involved with the Better Days Collective. Better Days came about after September 11th, but before the war in Iraq, in that time period. Some people from Philly had moved down and had been here for a little bit, and the Flying Brick folks had been here for a while. And there was an organization, the Richmond Anti-Globalization Network, that pretty much came out of the stuff out of Seattle and out of the anti-globalization movement that was growing. And that also had anarchists involved with it, you know, but some of us felt that, and as that anti-war movement was starting to develop, you know, some of us felt the need to have a specifically anarchist group at that time, you know, because you had the anti-globalization stuff developing and the anti-war stuff, and we were part of both of those movements, but we wanted to be clearer about our politics and what we thought were some of the solutions. So we formed the Better Days Collective, a handful of people from Flying Brick, myself, and a few Food Not Bombs people, kind of all of the usual suspects. We made really cool-looking banners. That was one of our things, like one of the signatures we tried to have, you know, as opposed to just showing up with that ugly-ass banner. Like, we took the time and really painted them, and we'd go to, like, the Labor Day demonstrations or the minimum living wage demonstrations and take part as anarchists, as a group, you know. We'd have communication with a bunch of the people that had been involved with those campaigns, you know, and with other union work, so they knew who we were, so when it wasn't like, the anarchists are coming, you know, it was like, oh, you guys are here, okay, cool, you know, yeah, so we would just take part in other things, you know, support other struggles, and some literature distribution, and we held a few events, but the group was actually pretty short-lived, once again, like, internal issues, you know, men not being accountable for their actions, just personality clashes, all sorts of things that kind of sunk the group before we got very far. But there were efforts while it was going to network with anarchists around the country. You know, it was one thing about having a specific anarchist group is there was interest in that point of building with a movement that was already out there. You know, whereas with the direct action stuff, we did some of that, but mainly around the summit hopping sort of thing, as opposed to building sustainable relationships of solidarity and support with people. There was some progress around that. That's how we ended up bringing Cindy Milstein here. Some people were really interested in the social ecology idea. I wouldn't say we were anywhere near a social ecologist group, but some people found a lot of that interesting, you know. And so the situation today in terms of anarchists in Richmond, what exists here now? I mean, there were about 35 people at the meeting last night,
yeah.
So there's obviously a reasonable number of anarchists.
Yeah. That was a good turnout. I was happy with that. I wasn't, you know, that it's pulled together local folks that didn't necessarily know each other. Somehow, through setting up a statewide thing, we're finding people that live 20 minutes from
us, you know, and other groups, other people that are in the city that we just haven't met. So people are trying to pull together around that. There hasn't been a distinct organization formed, like an anarchist grouping or collective of any sense yet, but there's been some discussion with it. Flying Brick is still going. They're still holding events, and it seems like they're actually, like, there have been times when their library has been pretty quiet, you know, but there have been a number of events and videos, showings, and there's a show there tomorrow night. So they're kind of having a little renaissance, and so that's looking good for them. The Food Not Bombs group is still going strong here. There's a number of anarchists that are involved with that, that are also involved with the Federation. There's a SDS group at the university, Students for a Democratic Society, from that, that helped build for your event that came out last night. And then there's just seems to be some random people. So things are looking good, you know.
So the city of Richmond itself, I don't know much about it. I mean, am I right in thinking it was the capital of the Confederacy during the Civil War?
Yeah, the first one.
Okay. You know, what are the kind of issues? I mean, you've talked about homelessness as one issue in terms of the city. What other ones are kind of the obvious things locally?
Homelessness and poverty in general are major issues. The city's still racist as it ever was, you know, in different ways. But it's a massive issue in the city. There's a fault lines. I mean, the city is extremely segregated economically and racially. There's like two Richmonds, three at least at this point. You know, there's the student areas and downtown, which are close together, you know. And then if you go across the bridge, it's like wide open, you know, like slow southern poor folks, you know, like it's just a different Richmond altogether. And then like certain areas are just really run down and everything. There are monuments to the Confederate war criminals that are prominently displayed throughout the city, that every year on the Jackson Day, they are celebrated as part of the state holiday, the Confederate generals. And groups will come out and protect the statues and things like that. There's bridges named after these people and everything. And there's a whole other history that's not acknowledged at all. Like I was telling you about the slave insurrection. Just now, there's a placard where the slave Gabriel, the insurrectionist, was hung. And that was put into effect several years ago by a community organization who had done the research and found out where he was killed. And it's off 15th Street and Broad, and just to the north of that is a parking lot that's owned by this university, which is one of the first African slave burial grounds in Virginia, under a parking lot. It's not even acknowledged. They were talking about building a baseball stadium down there, you know? So there's all this history that hasn't been acknowledged. And so when you look at the problems today of, like, just the way that the poverty has affected everything in the city, you know, and that the racism has affected everything in the city. Like,
so tell us about that insurrection.
Okay. 1800, there was a slave named Gabriel. He was on the Prosser plantation. He was a blacksmith, and at that time a lot of the slaves were hired out, you know, and so a skilled slave like himself was hired out from, you know, to different shops to perform his blacksmithing. And the plantation that he was on was out in Henrico. Brook Road runs right over here, and the Prosser plantation was right off Brook Road, probably about 10 miles out that way. And he started organizing a conspiracy for insurrection in the city. He had contacted over 1,000 slaves that were part of the program, that were going to be part of the insurrection. They had white French men assisting them and getting arms, and said that they would help get them out of Virginia if they needed to, if things went bad. It wasn't like things were going to go good. Even if they had abolished slavery, they knew that there was going to be consequences. So it was about 1,000 slaves organized. They'd been holding meetings out in the Henrico area. There's a park out there called Freedom Park, which is one of the spaces where the conspirators met. Gabriel was the ringleader, but he had close connections with a lot of other people who were very involved in the process of planning it. And their plan was a three-pronged strategy. They were going to catch the docks on fire at Rocky's Landing, and when the white folks rushed down They were going to use that as a chance to raid the armory and get the weapons. And the third group was going to go and kidnap the governor and hold him until he signed a declaration abolishing slavery. Sounds like a good plan. It probably would have worked. The problem being is that the night before, the night of the insurrection, there was a massive end-of-summer rainstorm like we get in Richmond, you know, and it washed out all the footbridges and some of the ability to pass bridges, and so they postponed it. And then two slaves about 20 miles down the river in Petersburg ratted him out, and Gabriel disappeared. It took several months to catch him. They hung 35 people for conspiracy. It set off a lot. It freaked out the slave class, you know, and started some of the earliest like slave patrols, which eventually became police departments and things like that, were started in response to this. You know, if in the book Roots, actually, there's even reference to it. It's a part of like the history of the time and just the ways that the white folks responded with such repression, you know.
Oh yeah, so the standard question I'm throwing at everybody is, we're in election season in the U.S., kind of in the primaries at the moment, and I haven't caught the news in the last couple of days, or whatever the latest thing's happening there, I'm not sure, but what's your take on the whole situation?
It's driving me crazy. It's just advertising, you know, like it's really just like an advertising campaign. It's like the pregame show for the Super Bowl, you know, but it started like 7 months early. It's ridiculous. I work at a bar. I talk to a lot of people. It's pretty much a Democrat bar, you know. Well, it's a bar. Anyone can come in. But a lot of the people that are regulars there, you know, they were talking about the primaries and who they voted for in Virginia's primary. And the reasoning that no one's talking about issues, you know, if people are talking about, well, Hillary just ain't going to win. That's just impossible. So I voted for Obama, you know. And someone said that they voted for Hillary because Oprah said Obama was going to win and they didn't want Oprah to be right. This is how you make political decisions? I mean, it's insane. I have to hear too much of it at work, you know. I'm not excited about it anyway. People know that I'm active and organizing and stuff, and they were all like, "We're disappointed in you. We're disappointed in you. You didn't even vote in the primary." And I'm like, "I'm not even sure I'm going to fucking vote in the election, you know? Like, it feels sinful." It doesn't feel good, you know. Anything you do in that machine doesn't feel good.
And do you think it says anything interesting in terms of the development of U.S. politics that, you know, you're in a situation where there's a possibility of the Democrats at least having either a black man or a woman for president as their candidate, maybe even getting elected? And that's obviously something pretty unimaginable in the 1950s. So.
Yes, that's true. That is true. Whether or not that'll have an effect on change, you know, I mean, the integration of elites doesn't necessarily mean that the rest of you, there's going to be that's going to happen on everyday levels, you know, like between people. Yeah, I mean, you've got Condoleezza Rice. I mean, that couldn't have happened in the 60s, but her politics are terrible and what she's doing is evil, you know, so I don't take much comfort in that. You know, I'd rather see somebody with principle regardless, you know, but if you're going to be in the presidency of the United States, you've lost principle a long time ago, so.